Hello and welcome to the final episode of Voicing Art, a new podcast highlighting creative voices on contemporary Arab art, made with Transmission Roundhouse. This episode looks at the theme of innovation through preservation. I really wanted to think about whether when we talk about preservation, are we talking about something static that simply preserves the past as it was? Or can it involve innovation and the creation of something new? Or alternatively, how can innovation lead to the destruction of what was there before?
The king said to the philosopher, "Now that I've heard a parable about how a crafty liar can drive friends apart and incite them to become enemies, tell me one about how sincere friendships begin and how each benefits by following the other's advice." "A wise man values nothing more than good friends," replied the philosopher. "Friends help us achieve good things and they console us in times of adversity. The story of the ringdove, the crow, the gazelle and the turtle is an example of this." "And what was their story?" asked the king.
My name is Ghazal Izraib, but everyone calls me Zalia. So if you see Zalia running around, that's why. I have a background in research, arts and culture. I actually used to be a teacher and ended up in curation.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania. I am an art curator and a social science researcher and a designer as well. I have a background in design, art history, and recently did a master's in social policy. I'm really interested in the intersection of art and social engagement and community work, also in relation to forced migration.
The voices you've just heard belong to Rania and Zalia. They've recently curated an exhibition called Kalila Wadimna, Ancient Tales for Troubled Times, at the P21 Gallery in London. The gallery aims to promote contemporary Arab art and culture, while also creating visibility for Arab artists worldwide. Kalila Wadimna itself is an ancient collection of fables with animals at their centre, and you could kind of think about them as being like Aesop's fables. The exhibition itself was centred around the tale of the four friends, also known as the Ringdove chapter. The story opens with a king asking his philosopher for a parable about friendship, the opening you heard just now. The philosopher proceeds to tell a story in which four animals, a crow, a mouse, a tortoise and a deer, are pursued by a foul-faced hunter. The animals must work together to outwit this hunter. And although it seems at first as though they have nothing in common, over time the animals work together, realising their differences are strengths, and ultimately are brought together through adversity. The exhibition invited established and emerging artists to become hekawertis, or storytellers. In various different media, including textiles, calligraphy, that's a combination of calligraphy and graffiti, video and more, the exhibition highlighted the influence of Eastern languages and cultures on Western societies and addressed both universal and highly personal issues, such as identity, community, migration and intercultural relations.
Kalila Wadimna, the name itself is from the Arabic version of the fables. It has origin in India from the, I think, 3rd century BCE, but that version did not survive. And then it was translated from that version, though, to Middle Persian, and from the Middle Persian, Pahlavi, to Arabic. And why the Arabic version is the version that we used in the exhibition, it's because the version that had the longest history, and it's through that version that the text was like disseminated in Europe, especially in the Middle Ages, and the text became cosmopolitan, and it was translated to more than 40 languages. And what's interesting about Kalila Wadimna, so it was highly relevant in the Middle Ages, and it's also, in terms of Arab, for the Arabic world, it's one of the first fiction prose works. It's also one of the most illustrated books. And what's interesting is that it had this kind of rise, and it's also had some classics, Ottoman classics and Persian classics in the 15th century. But then when some languages started dying, it lost a bit, it became a bit unknown, but it reserves its it was still known in the Arabic world. And we thought, since it was very much translated and it's a rich text with multiple framings, it starts with an advisor talking to a king or a prince about wisdom, about how to rule. But it also goes inside with animal characters, framing within framing, with different parables. So this is why it was translated so much, because each appropriation took different parables and different, what we call in Arabic, amthal, to use, you know, and to educate. The text itself is amazing because it's a combination of knowledge and entertainment. And Ibn al-Mukaffa, who translated to the Arabic version, said, or actually, let's say it's his version, he's an author, said that the text needs to be read slowly to gain knowledge, you know, and to interact with it critically. And we thought, why not bring this text to our modern age, contemporary, you know, with all what's happening around the world, and take from that wisdom, but also specifically from the chapter of the ring dove, or the tale of the four friends, that addresses friendship through sharing stories, through storytelling. So each artist took that text and addressed issues related to our time, pressing issues in our time, also in relation to friendship, understanding, migration, very important issues, you know, that needs to have multiple narratives, not one narrative.
Collaboration really ran through every aspect of the exhibition, and it was clear that Zalia and Rania had thought about their position as curators and the need to be receptive within that role.
We're very lucky to be working in London, which is a very diverse city, which has a lot of funding for, I want to say, grassroots projects in a way, but it's still not enough. And if you think about the cultural scene, you think about a gallery, you think about a museum, you don't think about people on the margins necessarily. You think about money, you think about prestige, you think about a lot of white people, that's often the case, a lot of abled people, a lot of, you know. So I think part of the idea of reaching out to these organizations was, first of all, widen access and inclusivity. But secondly, also, I think it's important for us as curators to understand that our job is curation. Our job is not to, we don't have the background and we don't have the expertise to go and approach people in certain communities, vulnerable communities, you know, even diverse communities, however diverse we are. I mean, we don't have that legitimacy. But Play for Progress, ELTA, that's their profession. They know what they're doing it, and they're doing it well. And just like you said, Rania, you know, I mean, Play for Progress has this very specific process of approaching art therapy in a way, I guess. We don't have that expertise. So we want to collaborate with people who do, who know what they're doing, and follow their lead, really, essentially. And I think it's important for people to remind themselves of that, because there's a lot of performative behavior going on, especially nowadays. And you need to sometimes, you know, put yourself in the backseat and be like, okay, to show me what I can do.
This sense of receptiveness, of listening to the community around them, was particularly clear in the workshops which ran alongside the exhibition.
They kind of took the text to a different dimension, you know, and it was beautiful to see the text was appropriated historically, and now it's like appropriated in very different ways. And speaking of access also, another, let's say, activity are the workshops that were done before the exhibition with students. Secondary school students and primary school students before that, with Dr. Rachel Scott, with artist Demma Wan, with also like textile artist Sonia Tutiet. And those workshops were like, there is a blog about them in the website. They were very much, you know, about art in schools. again, how much art is incorporated in schools, but not any kind of art, the art that creates conversation, where actually students sit and actually are allowed to, you know, share their experiences, their different heritage, but also how they relate to one another in the classroom, how they relate to the different languages they speak in such a, you know, diverse city like London or even around London, you know? So that mattered a lot. And I think honestly, one of the most amazing moments for us when, for example, the young people from Play for Progress came to the exhibition and saw their work, you know, and interacted with the music, but also when these students came to the exhibition and saw their textile little humans, you know, hanged up on the wall, you know, and they were really happy to see it there. Even, you know, that was like one of the, I think for me, one of the happiest moments. Yeah. Again, going back that it's a text about entertainment, but it's also a text about, it's also an insightful and for inspiration. And we wanted to bring it from the academic framework and bring it and bring it to the gallery, but not only to the gallery. Before the live exhibition, the text was touring in this community organization, East London Textile Arts in Newham, and Play for Progress, that is an organization that does trauma-informed music and art activities with minor asylum seekers. It was incorporated in their programs through, for example, for East London Textile Arts for more than a year. During the pandemic, lead textile artist Sonia Tutiet was touring the homes of the community members who actually like are involved in the textile work with ELTA in her bicycle, like distributing the pieces for them to work together on the animal characters, on the costumes. We're talking about diverse communities and people with different abilities. For Play for Progress in music and in art, it was incorporated in the program. Artist and curator Dima Karut worked with the young people on a simplified version of the story. So they took it, they simplified the version to make it accessible, talking about access, because not all the young people are proficient in English. They are, it's a process for them. And also they addressed the Arabic version because some of them talk Arabic. And they tried to illustrate the story in what means to them and how it's relevant to them. And same with the music, with musician Simon Roth. This is what they did. They built soundscapes, talked in those soundscapes, played different instruments. And we had that in an immersive experience in the gallery. And speaking of oral, there was also an animation in the gallery by artist Dima Nashawi and Ali Dalloul. That animation took the story and kind of went outside, inventing different characters, but also animal characters, and addressed and it was to address the destructive impact of human activity on the natural ecosystem. So here the story even went to another dimension, and actually within a very, very relevant topic, which is climate change and also the role of humans in that.
Along with climate change, another key theme which ran through the exhibition is that of migration. This theme also runs through the texts. The chapter of the ring dove takes place in a landscape of persecution and fear. The four friends must move from place to place to find safety. But the theme of migration is not just within the stories, it's within the very nature of the text itself.
If you think about it, the way the text has travelled, which is something we go in depth in the exhibition, thanks to the research Rachel has done. I mean, it went from India to the Ghaffa's translation, and then like spread across Turkey and Europe, and ultimately we find it in the Fable de la Fontaine, in the Canterbury Tales. You know, it's one of a truly foundational literary text, and I think that like I was saying at the beginning, even if we don't know what it actually refers to directly, even if we don't know Kalila Wadimna and we don't appreciate the Panchatantra and we don't realize that's where it's from, it's still going to be present in literature as a whole. Actually, on that subject, I'd like to give a shout out to the Migration Museum, where we did our first workshop. So that was the one with Demma Wan and Rachel and I. And we were privileged to... we had the amazing chance to meet these two schools. So there was a Muslim school and there is a Catholic school. And we brought in two classes. There were 55 children. That was a lot of children. I'm just going to say, like, a lot of children. I was a teacher and that was way too much for me. I was like, oh my goodness. But all these kids came in and they were your typical little London kids, you know, very diverse, lot of character. And they walked into the Migration Museum. So this was interesting because this was at the time they were based in, I think it was Vauxhall at the time, and they've actually moved since then, and they still don't have a permanent location, by the way. And I wanted to I think we should mention this, like, this is a really important museum. I mean, come on, we're in a country, the number one colonizer, right, in the world, and somehow the Migration Museum doesn't have a permanent location. That just doesn't make sense to me. But it was a very nice location at the time, and they had this lovely exhibition on, which featured, basically it allowed us to kind of humanize the life of a migrant or a child of a migrant, etc. And so it was kind of this immersive experience where you come in and you walk into someone's house and there's like stories of people, real stories, you know, from their families, from their travels, etc. And so the kids came in and they were walking around and they could see there was this part where there were even like blown up pictures of people's visas, you know, with their pictures there, and even for us, I mean, for me and Demma, it was very touching because we come from you know, parents who have migrated, so it's very sentimental. But seeing the kids go through that and looking through the records, and I remember there was this little kid, she was looking through a book and she saw a name. And it was her name. It was the same name. And she was like, that's my name, you know? And it's a great place because they get to touch everything. They encourage them to touch and play with everything. And they were like, this is a museum, but it's about us. And we're represented and we're here. And that is so important. That is so important.
Perhaps one of the most interesting things about the Khalilawa Dimna text is that the author of the tales in their most well-known form, Ibn al-Mukaffa, said that they can be read on many levels, be that from a perspective of pure entertainment, reading them simply as stories about animals, or even as political advice for kings and princes. And actually, sometimes the tales are seen as being part of the Mirrors of Princes genre. It seems unlikely that politicians today are taking advice from Khalilawa Dimna, but the wisdom contained within them remains relevant nonetheless. To take us back to Rania for a second, the environment and the changing environment was a key theme of the Khalilawa Dimna piece too. I also wanted to ask Rania and Zalia how they saw the future of the tales progressing. The tales were originally part of an oral tradition being passed down generation to generation, and perhaps part of their interest comes from them having survived for so long. I asked Zalia and Rania whether they thought the stories of Khalilawa Dimna would continue to exist long into the future.
I mean, definitely. I think so. Even maybe not directly quoting it, but I mean, it's the it's been what, 1,800 years since it was first written in India, and we're still going through the same stuff. Like it feels like nothing has changed in a lot of ways. I don't know. What do you think, Rania?
I think the question would be more how people read them, you know, and because now, I mean, the reflection is on how people are taking stories now in a very fast-paced world, you know, how would people read that text in the future? I would be interested to know, because when we started the exhibition, we went through the chapters and we read, and they take time, you know, it's not just, okay, you can read the simplified version, and for children you have like the text of the Children Museum of Indianapolis, which thankfully we had access to and we'd like to thank them. But so reading and listening is actually more of what I'm curious about in the future. But I would say a lot of the wisdom in the text would probably remain in a form or another, the parables, you know. And I hope imagination itself, you know, in this complex pattern remains. Again, from the text itself, you know, these are different animals who, the interesting part is when the mouse said to the crow, how can I be a friend with you? You know, you can eat me, you're a danger for me. So the idea of overcoming fear and, you know, and sharing a journey together is definitely very highly relevant. But more so, it's about how we're becoming lone societies, and that how was that highlighted in the pandemic, and even for art as a practice. Zalia talked about how performative it's becoming and returned into the individual and the individualistic experience. And I think this exhibition is also a call for collaboration, whether from the research to the curation, to each artist, to the organization, you know, about, you know, producing together, about hearing each other, about, so it's moving from that individualistic aspect and towards community, going back to community.
So if we can see P21's Khalila Wadimna exhibition as a building on top of something else, what about innovation that destroys what was there before? What about material culture and heritage that is destroyed as it is built on top of over time? Much of the Arab world is currently experiencing a boom in development. For example, this hugely ambitious NEOM project in Saudi, which is definitely worth looking up, or even the much criticised urban development in Ramallah, the capital of the Palestinian territories, which is destroying the historical old town. Of course, urban development is necessary, but we can definitely question whether it is being done in a sustainable manner and how much impact it has on the material heritage of a place.
Crossing a street in Cairo isn't a luxury or a fun activity. It is inevitable, especially given the public transport systems that don't accommodate otherwise. It's not an unusual scene to see individuals who are standing helpless waiting for a gap between vehicles. Likewise, car runovers are becoming more frequent. Those structures were installed with only one objective in mind, to pave the roads of the entire city towards a distant new capital, no matter how destructive to the city this becomes.
These words are taken from anthropologist and photographer Ibrahim Bahadine's project Skies of Concrete, which captures the changing urban scene in Cairo. Skies of Concrete consists of a series of photographs of the Egyptian capital and the new concrete structures which are appearing in the city, such as flyovers. Ibrahim's work is important as a means of documenting what there is now, before it changes beyond recognition. Skies of Concrete consists of a series of photographs of the streets of the Egyptian capital and the new concrete structures which are appearing in the city. And although the subjects of the photographs are not what might be considered beautiful in a traditional sense, the photos' warm golden tones and blue Cairo skies transform these construction sites into something more. There are no people in the shots, which creates a sense of intimacy, as the viewer feels like they've stumbled on an abandoned street during golden hour. I spoke with Ibrahim about this project and some of his other work, which also centres around documenting change in Egypt. We're quite used to thinking of pictures as capturing a single and static moment. So it struck me that Ibrahim had chosen this medium to show change.
The medium that I use specifically is film photography. And film photography is quite a slow process, at least for me. I really try to put as much as I could into making one image. To me, it's not really about capturing a static moment. It's about trying to compress as much as possible of the space and the time and the sentiments that revolve around this particular context into one single image. I think I've tried to achieve this documentation of the process of change by revisiting many of the spaces that I've shot before. So for photography to be a very static practice that tries to capture a specific moment, I don't think it's really limiting to my approach because I really try to put effort into bringing a lot of context and a lot of, you would say, aspects into this particular frame. So I think that doesn't mean that I'm not willing to work with other mediums than photography. I've been experimenting with film, like film as a medium itself, not film photography, and it's quite fulfilling as well. And I've been experimenting with making short experimental films with a tape camcorder. So I think photography is just the medium that I'm currently comfortable with due to its slow process and the mindfulness that it entails in the process of making one photograph. Yeah, that's why I'm mainly inclined towards photography as a medium. What I also particularly like about photography, especially film photography, that I get to be involved in the process as a whole. And that's especially because here in Egypt, we do not have as much accessibility to film labs and studios for you to have your films developed. So I got into the habit of developing and scanning my own films quite early. So I think I'm past this point, so I'm really used to doing this. It's sometimes it might be like a painful process to go through, but I particularly enjoy that I'm involved in the entire process of making a photograph. I think it makes me more invested in the process itself and more invested in creating the most out of each single frame.
When asking Ibrahim about his sources of inspiration, he emphasized that he doesn't see the people he photographs simply as subjects. Rather, in many ways, they're his collaborators.
For me personally, I think most of my projects come out of a certain personal interest in my subjects. And I'm particularly interested in communities that are off-grid, communities that are, I don't want to use the word unfamiliar, but they are, in a sense, becoming more unfamiliar to us these days. So I find it interesting to try to bridge the gap between topics that are heavily represented and heavily circulating around our very tiny circles and try to bring some outlooks from the outside into our circles. I'm just interested in having their input into our artistic practice. I'm using our artistic practice not in an exclusionary sense, but I'm using it as the culture itself of artistic practice have evolved into a very exclusionary space or scene that is not as inclusive as I would have hoped it to be. So I try to work with collaborators from areas and spaces that I would not normally be in. I'm not the only person who directs the photo. I'm not the person who, it's not my space, it's theirs. And they are the person in the photo. So I think they make up the most of the photograph itself. So I would definitely call them collaborators rather than subjects or mere interlocutors, because they bring in so much into the process of making the picture through my experience.
And talking to Ibrahim, it's clear that there's quite a deep sense of loss and maybe even melancholy that accompanies this urban development. In many ways, his projects are a race against time, attempting to document Cairo as it is now, before it changes past recognition.
For Skies of Concrete, I think it came out of a place of mourning and loss of how the city have transformed into. So I think because growing up, I spend much of my time growing up around green spaces, and I've been witnessing greenery quite regularly. So to suddenly witness an entire city become stripped off all the green spaces was quite hard to live with. The city itself has not been documented as much as it should be. So I've hoped to participate in documenting this process of change itself. It tells us something about what has been there before. So I think focusing on change is not the change itself as much as it is also what has been before the change and what's coming after this change. When trying to think through this, having in mind my project Mediterranean Encounters or Between Sand and Sea, I think in both projects I try to focus on the process of change, because a huge aspect of my work with the Bedouins was trying to understand how they are adapting to a massive change that is happening to their surroundings by the influx of tourists and state-funded projects of real estate and the taking over of the land, and how they are trying to make sense of their surroundings amidst all this precarity and change. So I think in both projects, I try to highlight this process of change and try to understand what has been happening before and what might be coming after this change.
Something else which came up in our conversation was the fact that change affects different people in different ways, and that urban development especially has an uneven effect across different groups.
It's really complicated because Cairo is quite a city that has a lot of variety. It's not a homogeneous inert matter. Change is definitely, and it's not favorable to most of Cairo residents because it's built on the premise of eradicating. So I think another example of Cairo and the urban change that's happening, I don't think it's in the favor of the majority of Cairo's residents. And it's actually quite the opposite of this episode's title. It's not about preservation. It's about stripping a whole city of its, I don't want to say essence because it's a very romanticized word, but it's stripping a whole city of its reality.
But it's important to be clear here. Ibrahim does not think that change in and of itself is inherently destructive.
Misguided change or change that is not natural, and the change that's not coming from the people themselves adapting to their surroundings, is the dangerous change. Change that is enforced on people is the dangerous change. So I think in both cases of the projects that I mentioned, change was enforced on the people. It was not chosen by them. So I don't think change in itself has to be inherently dangerous. It's only the change that's coming abruptly on people's lives.
My final question to Ibrahim was whether he thought preservation and innovation could exist alongside each other.
We can do so much with what the past has produced currently in Egypt. So yeah, I think they should exist together. The question is not can they exist together, the question is how we can make them exist together.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this is where you would usually have an outro, a summary of the episode, or even of the whole series, given that this is the final episode. And I did sit down to write something, but it all sounded, well, a little bit disingenuous. I don't know if this episode did answer the questions I set out with at the beginning. And since the whole point of the series was to platform other people's voices and opinions, it feels more fitting to leave the listener to come up with their own conclusions. We didn't have time to mention all the contributors and partners for the Khalil Adimna exhibition in the main body of the interview, but we'd like to mention the artists involved here. Alice Kettle, Ali J. Dalul, Dima Wan, Dima Nashawi, Jean Morris, Ryan Anayal, Vaishali Prasmari, and also the exhibition partners East London Textile Arts and Play for Progress. Khalil Adimna, Ancient Tales for Troubled Times, developed out of the work of Language Acts and Worldmaking, a flagship project funded by the ArtMentees Research Council. So I think my last thing to say here is thank you so much for listening to Voicing Art, and thank you to all the lovely people who've helped the series become a reality. You can follow the series on Instagram at Voicing Art, and who knows, perhaps there'll even be a series 2.